Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
I think that Kerouac, he had a brother whom he idolized, Gerard, who died when he was 9 and Kerouac was 3. And then a number of Kerouac's friends died in World War II, a great number of them. And I think that there's much that could be gained from those biographical details, because that seems to affix Kerouac with a sort of lifelong fascination or even obsession with mortality and how literature or art might be some kind of bulwark against impermanence. And so part of the memory project becomes about that, right? It becomes a way of dealing with impermanence, and Buddhism gave him one way to think about impermanence. The other thing that I would say is that those deaths and their impressions upon him also explain another characteristic of Kerouac's literature, in that it tends not only to be autobiographical, but often about male loneliness and vulnerability and male relationships. There are a lot of buddy books, right? And so in Dharma Bums, he's buddies with Gary Snyder, and On the Road, he's buddies with Neil Cassady. And it's all, you know, so much of the literature becomes about these insecurities surrounding male relationships, which I think have something at least to do with the trauma of loss of friends and male family members early in his life.
Walking is the exact balance between spirit and humility. The words of American beat poet, essayist, and environmental activist Gary Snyder. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. What does it mean to be a radical thinker? And was Jack Kerouac the unwilling father of the beat generation? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to explore those questions with two fresh and vibrant thinkers, one an American, the other a Dutchman, writers of tremendous insight, hope and opinion. Todd Titchen unpacks the roots and roots of beat icon Jack Kerouac, and Rutger Bremen defends his radical manifesto, Utopia for Realists, published by Bloomsbury. But first, is there a better way to live? And can the problem of homelessness be solved in our lifetime?
Well, my name is Rutger Bremen, and I recently read the book Utopia for Realists, published by Bloomsbury. And it's a book with a very simple question, actually. It's about how can we make utopia real? I think that the big problem of today is not so much that we don't have it good, but that we have no new radical vision of where we want to go next. So in my book, I propose three ideas: a universal basic income for everyone to completely eradicate poverty, a radically shorter working week of about 15 hours a week, and open borders around the globe. Now, all these ideas may seem pretty crazy. I always like to remind people that every milestone of civilization, at the end of slavery, democracy, equal rights for men and women, you know, these were all utopian fantasies once. So progress, as Oscar Wilde once wrote, is the realization of utopias. And that's why we need to relearn how to think in utopian.
Really well done on the book, Rutger. It is such an expansive read. It's so ambitious, hopeful, brilliantly argued, I have to say. But in terms of taking a kind of a deeper perspective on where humanity is going, I really think it's quite something. On that point, I might throw you a big wide open question. Do you think ideas can change the world? Do you think we can hope, at least, that ideas can change the world?
Definitely. I mean, we can think so and we can hope so because ideas have changed the world in the past. I mean, there are so many examples. If you just think about, for example, the women who were arguing in favor of the women's right to vote at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, you know, these women were not the people with most power in society or with the most money, but they did have an incredibly powerful idea and they won. So I think time and time again, there are examples in history where ideas really can and do change the world. And actually, it works both ways. So you could also see, Brexit and the rise of Donald Trump. These are also examples of the power of utopian thinking. You know, this would have seemed unimaginable just 10, 20 years ago, and here we are. So, yeah, I think that really proves that if you want to change the world, you need to have faith in the power of ideas.
Utopia for Realists, who are you aiming the book at? I know it's been pitched as neo-utopian literature, whether you'd agree with that or not. But I'm just wondering, where do you think the market is for a book like this?
Well, it's basically a book for everyone who has questions about the future and who feels that traditional left or right political parties don't have the answers anymore. People want to move beyond the old and boring political distinction between the left and the right, who are interested in new ideas. And, you know, sometimes these people are young, sometimes they're not. Often they are outside of mainstream political and journalistic circles. They're outside of the mainstream, often. But I don't know. It's not specifically marketed to a specific group or anything.
You quote the great French mathematician Pascal, who wrote that humanity is great because it knows itself to be wretched. That made me laugh hard. But he's got a point, hasn't he?
Well, actually, he had a point when he lived, you know, this was centuries ago. It was also the British philosopher who at the same time wrote that life is basically nasty, brutish and short. And for thousands of years, this was true, you know, about 99% of human history, about 99% of humanity was sick, poor, hungry, stupid, dirty, afraid, and ugly. You know, that is the natural state of humanity. And it only started to change a very short while ago. Actually, we've seen tremendous progress in the past 200 years after the Industrial Revolution, but especially after the Second World War. You know, nowadays, we are richer, wealthier, and healthier than ever. So again, I think the big problem is not that we don't have it good. We have achieved a lot of things in the past. But the thing is, we don't know where to go next.
So you think we lack the imagination, whether it's politicians, community activists, all sorts of different types of thinkers, that they lack the imagination to think differently,
exactly,
to take us to the
exactly.
next phase?
Let me give you an example. I mean, the left or progressives used to know very well what they were for. But nowadays, they only seem to know what they're against. And they're basically against a lot of things, you know, against austerity, against the establishment, against homophobia, against racism, against growth. Now, I'm not saying I'm not against all those things, but you also need to be for something. You know, Martin Luther King, he did not say, I have a nightmare. He had a dream. So that's why I think we need to formulate new dreams.
Well, what does a civilized society look like to you? Or how do you understand human progress in your own lived experience of the world?
Well, in the book, I argue in favor of what you could call real freedom. I think that everyone should have the means and the freedom to decide for himself what to do with his or her life. So we've got two big problems at the moment. The first is that millions of people around the developed world in very rich countries are still stuck in poverty. It's an incredible waste of human potential. Actually, I try to show in my book that it's cheaper just to completely eradicate poverty than to combat the symptoms of it. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is that millions and millions of people with excellent resumes and great salaries feel that their jobs have little meaning or significance. You know, a recent poll in the UK actually found that as much as 37% of British workers have a job that they think to be completely useless, meaningless. So I think we completely need to rethink what work is. And a basic income would give everyone the means and the opportunity to decide for his or himself what to do with his or her life and how to contribute to the common good. So that's very basically the kind of society that I envision. It's all about freedom.
You bring up the work of the British economist from the University of Manchester, I think, Joseph Hanlon, who argues poverty is fundamentally about lack of cash. You can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps if you have no boots. And you bring up a very visionary project in Britain, which is supporting the homeless through giving homeless people a certain stipend to empower their lives. Can you talk to me about, I think it's the Broadway project in London?
Yeah. Well, let me first say, some people might remember the quote of Margaret Thatcher, who said years ago that poverty is a personality defect, a lack of character, basically. Now, not many people nowadays would be so blunt, but the underlying idea is actually pretty common, that there's something wrong with the poor themselves, and that maybe we should teach them how to live their lives, or we should hold them responsible for their own mistakes. But, you know, the idea that there's something wrong with the poor is pretty common, actually. But if you look at the scientific evidence and some fascinating new scientific evidence, it also shows that poverty is not a lack of character. It's just a lack of cash. And it's pretty easy to cure a lack of cash. You know, you just need to give cash. You just need to give money, get people out of poverty. And then what we find in all these experiments is that people get up, do something with their lives, healthcare costs go down, crime goes down, mental health complaints come down, and a lot of other very positive developments. And one of the many stories that I tell in the book that show this is indeed the experiment that happened in London in 2009. So what happened here is this was an experiment with homeless people who had been living on the street for years and years, so some of them for more than 40 years. And at some point, Broadway, and a charity organization, decided, you know what, we're going to try something new. They'll all receive £3,000, and they're completely free to decide for themselves what they want to spend it on. And you know, even at that organization, quite some of the social workers were skeptical, you know, aren't these men going to waste it on drugs or alcohol? But actually, they used the money really well. You know, they spend it on a dictionary or hearing aid, or one of the men took gardening classes. And most importantly, a year after the experiment, 7 out of 13 of the men had a roof above their head. 2 more had applied for housing. Now, what you should know is that this doesn't only make moral sense, it also makes financial sense. So the project costs about £50,000. But it costs about £400,000 to let these people live on the street in terms of healthcare costs, police expenses, etc. So they had saved a lot of money. Even The Economist, you know, not exactly a left-wing paper, even The Economist wrote that the best way to spend money on the homeless might be just to give it to them.
Why do you think it is, though, that a lot of, whether it's different types of charities or through government schemes, that they haven't maybe put choice in the hands of those who are homeless, that they haven't used that as an empowerment tool, and that they're very unwilling to give cash as maybe a handout, because they would see, look at things that maybe that, you know, the idea that it will be disincentive maybe in some way?
Well, the problem is that the left thinks that people will be lazy and will quit their jobs or something. And it also doesn't trust people to make its own choices. I mean, that's basically what the left and the right agree on nowadays. There's so much paternalism. There's so much bureaucracy.
What do you say to the argument that society can't function without some degree of inequality? I know it's not very palatable, but what do you say to that charge? That, you know, inequality does benefit some.
I'm not arguing in favor of communism or anything. I'm not saying that everyone should receive the same amount of money. A basic income is just a platform, you know, it's just a floor, it's a base where you could also see it as venture capital for the people. It will give everyone the opportunity to try something new. And I think that's what capitalism is all about, right? Having the ability to take risks, to start a new company, to move somewhere else. And the problem is that many, many people, especially the poor, don't have the ability to take risks. And then we shouldn't be surprised that there's not a lot of innovation going on. Because, I mean, in the end, humans and human talent is the real capital we've got. So we need to unleash that. And people are allowed to earn as much as they want on top of that basic income.
Rutger, you write, it's no longer possible to express our prosperity in simple dollars, pounds or euros. From healthcare to education, from journalism to finance, we're all still fixated on efficiency and gains, as though society were not one big production line. But it's precisely in a service-based economy that simple quantitative targets fail. So within that, do you think everything in life is measurable? Can we come at life like that? Do you think that's a positive thing?
Well, let me say I'm not against measuring things. But you need to think really hard about what numbers you're using and what the values and assumptions are behind the numbers. So let me give you an example. If you'd ask an economist, what is productivity? He or she would say, well, productivity is very easy. It's just the amount of money you contribute towards GDP, basically the amount of money you earn. But if you don't think about that definition of productivity, that's a pretty weird definition. I mean, that would mean that a flash trader on Wall Street who doesn't contribute anything of social value actually probably destroys social value. That means that he or she would be very productive, while a garbage collector would be pretty unproductive because, I mean, these people don't earn that much money. Well, actually, if you think about the question, what would happen if a garbage collector would go on strike? Well, that's pretty terrible, right? I mean, I've got one story in the book of a strike that happened in New York 1968, of strike of garbage collectors, and that lasted for 6 days, and then the emergency state had to be declared. It was a complete disaster. You know, an average city can't survive without garbage collectors. And then I wondered, has it ever happened that the bankers went on strike? And actually, this is pretty funny. I found only one example in all of world history, and this was Ireland 1970, where the bankers decided, you know what, we think our wages aren't high enough, we're going to stop working. Now, that strike lasted for 6 months, so not 6 days, but 6 months, and nothing much happened. You know, the economy just kept growing, and after 6 months, the bankers came back and said, all right, we'll start working again. So I think these kind of stories show you that the question, what is productivity, is not something that we should hide behind numbers or something. We need to have a real democratic debate about what we really value as a society. Well, I think that garbage collectors are a lot more important than bankers, to be honest.
But you could get five people in a room, Rutger, and they would all have a different opinion on how you build a productive economy. Because we all have different demands within that, and we're all looking at it from very different ways and very different approaches.
Sure, and that's why we've invented democracy, right? To have a proper conversation about that and make compromises and et cetera, et cetera. But what we've now done is hide those assumptions behind numbers, and we have more and more people working in jobs that they say, I mean, it's not just me saying it, they say it, that they don't contribute anything of value. I mean, it seems as if our economy is completely upside down. The more money you earn, the less you contribute. There's this great quote from a former math whiz who worked at Facebook who said that the best minds of my generation are thinking about how to make people click ads. And indeed, it is what we see in the data is that since the 1980s, more and more, you know, smart young people who used to go and work for government or for university or research organizations, they now all work in the financial sector, or they work for big companies like Google and Facebook, trying to think about how we can click on ads more. Now, that's pretty sad, isn't it? I mean, some people wonder why the rate of innovation is not as fast as it used to be. Well, I think it is a pretty easy answer, because so many smart people are wasting their time right now in a useless job. We should have a real conversation about that.
You pitch up a very interesting question, Rutger. You ask, is there anything that working less does not solve? Will you tell me?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's quite interesting is that so many of the challenges we face right now, from, you know, the epidemic of stress, but also climate change, time and time again, the answer is just working less. And I don't say working less so that we can sit more on the couch, but working less so that we can do more. So nowadays, we keep on working in jobs we don't like, to spend money on things we don't care about, to impress people we don't like either. So that's pretty sad. What I think we should do is work less so that we have more time to spend on our kids, on our family, caring for our elderly, volunteers work, build social capital. And then, yeah, it's pretty interesting to look at the research and see that a healthy society, a much more sustainable economy, definitely depends on having a lot shorter work week.
What do you think the London School of Economics anthropologist David Graeber offered the debate? I know you mention his very influential article or essay on the phenomenon of bullshit jobs, but how do you think he stretched how we view our working week?
Well, I think he is one of the most interesting thinkers of our time, especially that essay. I'd recommend it to anyone because he has a very smart definition of what a bullshit job is. You know, he's an anthropologist. I'm a historian. Some people might say, well, you've got the real bullshit jobs. But the thing is, people can define it for themselves. So it's pretty interesting. You know, when I started writing about this, I thought, how big can this be? Then I wrote my first piece about it, and the confessions just kept pouring in, you know. People were telling me all the time, like, yes, I've got one of those jobs as well. And what's even more interesting is the phenomenon that I discovered of the part-time bullshit job. So this happens a lot in journalism. Let me give you an example. You're a young journalist, and you really want to do investigative journalism into companies that you don't like, but you don't have the money to do so. It's pretty expensive. So what you do is you make ads and branded content for companies that you hate. So then you use that money to do investigative journalism into exactly those kind of companies. So in modern capitalism, time and time again, we finance the stuff that we really care about with bullshit. You know, it's completely upside down. And what I try to propose in the book is to turn it around and to start with doing the things we really care about.
You argue, in the end, it's not the market or technology that decides what is real value, but society. If we want this century to be one in which all of us get richer, then we'll need to free ourselves of the dogma that all work is meaningful. Can you talk me through that?
I'd like to move towards a different definition of work. So the definition of work we now have is that work is the thing you do in a hierarchical relationship with an employer, and you get paid for it, and you pay taxes over it, and that's work. And everything else, all the volunteers' work, everything that doesn't contribute to GDP, we don't consider that work. And I think that's a ludicrous definition. And I'd like to propose a different definition of work, which is work is adding something of value, doing something that makes the world a little bit more interesting, a little bit more beautiful, a little bit more happier or whatever. And that's what we should consider work, whether it's unpaid or paid. And, you know, it's a very easy way to find out whether your work is valuable or not. Just stop doing it and see what happens. You know, if all the writers in the world would go on strike, you know, that's probably a problem. I think I like books, so that's probably going to make the world a little bit less interesting. If all the garbage collectors are going on strike, if all the doctors go on strike, that's a disaster. You know, these people are doing incredibly valuable work. But then imagine what would happen if all the bankers go on strike. What would happen if all the telemarketeers go on strike? If everyone in marketing would go on strike? Well, maybe that's not going to be a very big problem. Maybe this is a very easy way to think about what is work and what is not work.
You quote an Oxford study, Rucker, which you made for frightening reading, which suggests that 47% of all American jobs and 54% of all European jobs are at risk of being usurped by machines. And you mention a futurologist, I think his name is Ray Kurzweil from MIT, who believes that by 2029, computers will be just as intelligent as human beings. Is that not a little sensationalist?
Well, at the end, it doesn't really matter how long it will take. What really matters is what will happen. And it's pretty clear that technology will advance and that more and more jobs will be taken by the robots. And I think this is actually great news. But I don't agree with all these people in Silicon Valley who say that this will cause mass unemployment. I mean, I'm a historian. If you just go back in history and look at the news articles that were being published in the 50s and the 60s, you know, this is an old story that the robots are going to take our jobs and that will have mass unemployment. The thing is, we can consistently underestimate capitalism's extraordinary ability to come up with new bullshit jobs. So I think that the real barrier to a prosperous free society is not technology. The problem is not in technology or economics. It's ideology. You know, we can, even if all these robots will take all those jobs, there's always a millionaire who wants to be scratched on his back. So sure, we can come up with new jobs. If you want to see what the future looks like, just go to the U.S. You know, there are many jobs in the U.S., for example, people at Walmart just saying hi to everyone who enters. I mean, there are many stupid jobs that you can invent in the future. What I think is that we should just get rid of this ideology of work and completely redefine it.
And that was Dutch historian, economist and writer Rutger Bremen. Utopia for Realists and How We Get There is published by Bloomsbury and retails for in around €23 in hardback. Now, I have to say hats off to Rutger. This is one hell of a book. It's ambitious, courageous and hugely well merited.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Okay, let's stick with the themes of movement and progress and meet with one of America's most misunderstood writers, Jack Kerouac.
Hi, my name is Todd Teachin. I am Associate Professor of American Literature at University of Massachusetts at Lowell, where I teach courses predominantly in 20th and 21st century American literature. I am also the Associate Director of the Jack and Stella Kerouac Center for Public Humanities at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, through which we put on a variety of public humanities programming. In September 2016, The Unknown Kerouac was released by Library of America. It's in volume edited by me. That volume contains a number of Kerouac's previously unpublished writings, stretching over the arc of his life from the time he was a college student at Columbia University until his death. So there are some early essays that he wrote as a student at Columbia and some early journal entries. And the volume concludes with a piece called Spotlight, which was a 3-foot scroll that Kerouac was working on at the time of his death.
Really well done on the book. And I have to say, what an interesting collection of essays and writing we get in The Unknown Kerouac Taught. So thanks very much for that, and extremely well done. I think it really puts Jack Kerouac's writing in perspective and shows really what an ambitious fellow he was. Do you think Kerouac's literary ambitions and his aesthetic aims and vision have been somewhat misunderstood? Because a lot of people will just look at On the Road as distinct from his other extraordinary writing. And by that, all the kind of the hype has obscured some of his other aims.
I think that that's true. I think that he saw that as the case. That, you know, Kerouac came to popularity in the 1950s in the United States. And it wasn't only because... On the Road was critically celebrated in the New York Times and everywhere else as an important generational statement. But Kerouac also had a look, and he was branded in a certain way by publishers and sort of as the literary James Dean or Marlon Brando at the time. And what ended up happening is that certain people saw him as a sort of faddish writer, right, and a face rather than an artist, and his literary ambition was far greater than that. And I think his literary accomplishment was far greater than that too. And one of the things that's happened over the past, I'd say, you know, decade or so, really the past couple of decades, is there have been a lot of materials from Kerouac's archive that have been published, and people are starting to get a more rounded, a fuller idea of who he was as a person. I've written elsewhere about Kerouac's project being a maximalist aesthetic endeavor, and I think that that's really important for people to understand, but it's difficult for us to get to. And let me explain what I mean by that. On some level, I've become convinced that Kerouac thought that almost every bit of anything that he'd written over a 30-plus year period was the literary project, right? Like that he had to introduce it to the public through books and through the sort of novelized forms and through poetry. But really what he was involved in was this project that was occurring at this tremendous scale, at the scale of an entire archive of letters and journals and everything else. And it was a record of his experience of the world.
Can we talk about The Night Is My Woman? It's one of the stories that you do highlight in The Unknown Kerouac, and you describe it as one of his more candid and raw pieces of writings. I'm just wondering, how good is it?
You know, I think it's very good. I think it's one of the little jewels of the collection. It's interesting because it was originally written in French patois. Both of Kerouac's parents were born in Quebec and then migrated into New England, into first New Hampshire and then Massachusetts. And so Kerouac, he didn't speak English until he was 7 or 8 years old. So he grew up speaking this patois of French Canadian or Quebecois. But for The Night Is My Woman, one of the things that's interesting to me is that it was originally written in patois, and then he starts to translate it into English himself. But what strikes me about that story is it's really a more stripped down style that we get from Kerouac. The sentences are less ornamental, they're shorter, and we hear at first a different kind of voice emerging out of the French, because maybe he's not as confident writing in that as he is writing in American English. Another thing is, I think that there's a certain existential tone that struck in The Night Is My Woman. The narrator reminds me of the kind of narrator that we might find in maybe Dostoevsky and maybe someone like Celine. And I think that that's a little different for Kerouac as well. There's not as much exuberance, and there's not as much in terms of this sort of ecstatic moments, right? These moments of reaching some sort of bliss in existence. Those seem few or far between. they also ask us to reconsider Kerouac's interest in things like movement, right? His interest in movement is not necessarily only about being a freewheeling teenager or 20-something in America and reliving the pioneer tradition. Like, there's something about his family history and having to migrate from place to place within an immigrant culture that maybe sparked his interest in movement as a literary trope.
But if we look at, let's say, Conrad or Beckett or other great writers, lots of them were, you know, not just literary geniuses, but linguistic geniuses writing in not their native voice. And a lot of people would probably forget that Kerouac was a French-Canadian, first and foremost, and saw that culture as part of the drive throughout his whole life. I'm just wondering, Kerouac never voted in any American elections, but he's always seen as this poster boy or icon for revolution and for protest. It's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, getting back again to, and I think that you have this in the volume, The Unknown Kerouac. So in the 1960s, Neal Cassady, who was a longtime friend of Kerouac and served as the character prototype for Dean Moriarty, had taken over driving Ken Kesey's bus. Ken Kesey, the American writer, had a hippie bus that was called Further, and he traveled back and forth across the country with a bunch of people who were, I suppose, spreading the religion of LSD ingestion, right? It was this sort of hippie bus, and Neal Cassady was the driver of it, and they pick up Allen Ginsberg in New York at some point in 1967, and Ginsberg comes up with the idea that they should go visit Kerouac in Lowell, and Kerouac walks onto the bus, and he sees someone sitting on an American flag that's draped across a couch, and he says to the young man, "Can you please get up?" And the man gets up, and then Kerouac folds the flag in sort of proper style and places it somewhere. And in that moment, that's a really, I think that that story is so interesting to me because it provides some insight into Kerouac's politics, which are really complicated. Yeah. I don't think that Kerouac saw himself necessarily as the bringer of the counterculture. Other people saw him as this sort of forerunner of the counterculture, but his politics are really quite complicated, so that in a work such as, even in his early essays, you find two different Kerouacs. So the essays that I was thinking about were on contemporary jazz, bebop, in which he talks about young people in the United States and bebop and contemporary jazz in the decade following World War II, and how this is representative of some new, you know, vital American youth movement and youth energy, and it's an aesthetics of freedom that America is going to give to the world. And in that essay, you sort of hear that kind of countercultural and utopian progressive Kerouac. But then there's an essay that's in the same notebook called A Couple of Facts Concerning Laws of Decadence, in which he's talking about how lost he feels in New York and how he feels that, you know, New York liberals don't respect the small towns that he comes from, and they don't respect ideas about kinship and family. To circle back to something we were talking about earlier, we're back to this dichotomy between movement and feeling rooted somewhere. And so over the course of Kerouac's literature, you'll really find that he's torn between these really kind of conservative or nostalgic or sentimental longings for the past, right, on one hand, and this hunger for the future on another. And I think that that's one of the reasons why he never voted.
Just wondering, Todd, how committed a Buddhist was he? You mention in the book that he read a lot of classical Buddhist texts, and he really applied himself to kind of getting at the source. But I'm just wondering, in his daily life, how much did he draw down from different ideas and so on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a couple of ways to to answer that. I think that Gary Snyder's frustration with Kerouac, and you know, maybe it's one that I even share at times, and I hate to sound so judgmental, right? But you can't be a completely drunken Buddhist. In the kind of Zen Buddhism that Snyder was trying to introduce Kerouac to is about clarifying your mind and clarifying the way that you see the world. And if you're struggling with alcohol addiction all the time, it's hard to get to those places, right? It's hard to meditate while inebriated. So I think that Kerouac, for a period of his life, was very drawn to Buddhist ideas, and he internalized a lot of them and knew a lot of the classic Buddhist canon. Ultimately, he didn't have it in him to become a Buddhist in the way that Gary Snyder or Philip Whalen or a number of other writers associated with the counterculture did.
So what you're trying to say is that he thought he could throw himself into Buddhism to maybe stretch his understanding of meaning and truth and awareness within the world. Is that it?
Yeah, and I think that Kerouac, he had a brother whom he idolized, Gerard, who died when he was 9 and Kerouac was 3. And then a number of Kerouac's friends died in World War II, a great number of them. And I think that there's much that could be gained from those biographical details, because that seems to affix Kerouac with a sort of lifelong fascination or even obsession with mortality and how literature or art might be some kind of bulwark against impermanence. And so part of the memory project becomes about that, right? It becomes a way of dealing with impermanence, and Buddhism gave him one way to think about impermanence. The other thing that I would say is that those deaths and their impressions upon him also explain another characteristic of Kerouac's literature, in that it tends not only to be autobiographical, but often about male loneliness and vulnerability and male relationships. There are a lot of buddy books, right? And so in Dharma Bums, he's buddies with Gary Snyder, and On the Road, he's buddies with Neil Cassady, and it's all, you know, so much of the literature becomes about these insecurities surrounding male relationships, which I think have something at least to do with the trauma of loss of friends and male family members early in his life.
And the freedom that masculinity provides. I thought it was very interesting when you mentioned his hospital journals. And we get a very kind of complex presentation of who Jack Kerouac really was. And you write that, you know, that it goes back and forth between sudden bursts of literary confidence and mountainous doubt, between illumination and the psychic pain that often sends him spiraling into binge drinking and the like. Was he always grappling with that sense of, I suppose, not just being an outsider, but not fitting in with anything, that he always had tremendous doubt about anything that he could do?
I believe that that's true, and I'm not sure what all of the psychological reasons would be for that, but it does appear to be. I mean, just for instance, Kerouac was a very celebrated athlete, even in high school. He got to go to Columbia University because of his talents as a football player and as a runner in track. While they didn't give athletic scholarships, they were more prone to give him a scholarship because of those abilities. But it was also because he was quite smart, and he had read all of the Lowell Public Library by the time he graduated high school. But I think even those two sides of him were at war with each other, that he got around sort of all of these bohemian and hipster figures in New York, but he looks like a fullback or a linebacker. And so he's part jock, part intellectual. And I think that caused him a great deal of, I suppose, cognitive dissonance, we would say.
You have a very interesting interview in the book with John Sellon Holmes. I think he was a lifelong pal of Jack Kerouac. And it was taken, I think it's from 1949, where Kerouac says, I saw that a writer can become a sort of society figure as long as he observes the rules, more or less, can in fact become a criminal among the rich, that is, a criminal bullshitter. He was so unbelievably self-critical. Like, I wonder, did he rate himself at all?
Well, I mean, I think that, and this might be a shortcut, but I mean, we might talk about Kerouac's Catholicism in relation to some of this, rather than his Buddhism. There are a number of ways to think about Kerouac as a Catholic writer. We were talking before about his autobiographical aesthetic. So there's the whole idea of confession, right? Mm. Of the sacrament of confession becoming this kind of act of writing, and you put all of this on the page, whether it is something that will maybe make you look bad or not, right? Whether there are sins or virtues, you own up to it. But I wonder how much of that sort of self-scrutiny of fearing that one is somehow inherently sinful and fallen played into some of these self-image issues. I'm tempted to say, based on our conversation, that one of Kerouac's problems is that his Catholicism ultimately trumps his Buddhism.
It's an interesting way to look at him and his writing, and that the clutches of Catholicism, he couldn't break free from it. But it presents so many different directions and interpretations on his life. I haven't read Vision of Cody, and I know that Jack Kerouac thought that it was his masterpiece. It was written between 1951 and 1952, I think. Where do you stand in all of that? Do you think it's better than On the Road and maybe Bixer and Dharma Bums or what?
I mean, I think that... okay, so I want to say... On the Road is to Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, as Visions of Cody is to Ulysses. It's a really much more ambitious and experimental narrative work than On the Road is. And it's meta to the extent that it's more about perspective, or what it might mean to tell a story about Neal Cassady, what would be the proper perspective or narrative perspective. So Kerouac tries third person, he tries first person. At one point in the narrative, he just transcribes a bunch of tape recordings of him and Neil talking, and there's very little in terms of chronology. So I understand why Kerouac saw it as his aesthetic masterpiece or his artistic masterpiece, because he's able to do a lot of different things and inhabit a lot of different perspectives and voices. But I think that it's probably not the place to start. If you're going to start reading Kerouac, it's probably not the place to start, because it's a really challenging work.
Todd, is his poetry as spiritual and as spontaneous as some of his literary texts? Do we get that same bite and engagement, do we?
Wow. I mean, I think that Mexico City Blues is a spiritual text, and I think it deals with a lot of the sort of Buddhist ideas that we were talking about. Kerouac, in terms of, you know, the term samsara, he uses the term meat wheel instead, right? How I wish I was off of this meat wheel and safe in heaven, dead forever. So, I mean, possibly. I mean, the thing that interests me is Kerouac is a prose writer among a movement of writers who are mostly poets. And so I don't think that he saw the divisions between poetry and prose as starkly as some do. I think that he saw his poems as a form of prose and his prose as a form of poetry.
Shows you what an artist he was, doesn't it? Because he had that space and capacity to think differently.
I think that that's one of the things that comes across in The Unknown Kerouac. I mean, we're talking about Joyce, but there are so many references and allusions to figures other than Joyce, Chaucer, Shakespeare, Celine, Proust, that it becomes clear when you start going through these writings, and especially the journals, that Kerouac understands his literature as occurring within a certain literary history and within a certain context, and he has certain aims within that context. A couple of weeks ago, I have 9-year-old nephews, and they were visiting me, and I was showing them some art books, and they saw some paintings by Jackson Pollock and Keith Haring and Jean-Michel Basquiat, and their responses were, well, I could do that. And I thought, well, of course you can't, right? And the thing is they're seeing these paintings out of context. They're seeing these paintings as these sites of improvisation and spontaneity and sort of wild creativity. And they think, well, I can do that. Just give me a paintbrush and I'll throw some paint around. And I think that's really similar to the way in which people have seen Kerouac for a long time, that he was operating in this way that was unmoored, and he was sitting down. You know, the famous insult by Truman Capote when he read On the Road is, that's not writing, that's typing, right? That he sat down at the typewriter and he just started pounding out 90 words a minute, and he's this intuitive talent. But the thing that comes across is that he has a real understanding of what the history of pilgrimage is in Western literature as a convention. He has the understanding of what the history of experimentation with language from the point of view of people like Joyce is, and he's operating within a context. And I think that, you know, in terms of those fears that he expresses to Holmes in that interview about dying and not being respected as an artist, really come down to that in terms of in being framed, as I said earlier, as this kind of literary Marlon Brando or literary James Dean, what was cut off by the frame was the extent to which he was grounded in knowledge of literary craft.
One of the interesting aspects of Jack Kerouac's life was that he was a big lover of music, and he was obsessed with jazz particularly, and, you know, hung around with lots of jazz musicians and went to lots of different improvised musical performances. I'm just wondering, how did that jazz landscape affect his literary voice and that idea of improvisation, that idea of experimentation, and, you know, the free throw, the let go that we get in jazz, and that makes jazz so brilliant. He's a jazzy writer to a degree, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very much the case. I think that, so a couple of things. I mean, one, we were just talking about Kerouac in terms of literary history and understanding his place within literary history. And really what we were talking about is the need to, as an artist, know the rules before you know which rules to break, right? And so there's that. And one of the things that comes across in not only The Unknown Kerouac, but in 2007, the scroll version of On the Road was published, and that was accompanied by a number of really excellent critical essays. And what's become clear as people have worked more and more on Kerouac's archive is that On the Road, even though it's been mythologized as this text that Kerouac sort of pounded out in 3 weeks in spontaneous fashion at the typewriter, that's not completely true. It's a book that Kerouac thought about for a decade before he got to April 1951, where he sat down in front of the typewriter and then performed on what we now know of as On the Road in 3 weeks. So I did want to point that out, that there's still a sort of balance. At some point, Kerouac sees the spontaneous gesture as a way to get the narrative out, but he's already thought about how to line up his notes before he has sat down to play. It might be a way to think about it. The other thing that I would say is that in terms of spontaneity in the 1950s, in the late 1940s and the late 1950s in America, you have these figures like Jackson Pollock and Charlie Parker who are making a real art form out of improvisation and spontaneity, one in painting and one in terms of the alto sax. And Kerouac is typically seen as sort of the literary equivalent, or their literary brother in some way.
Last question for you, Todd. For those who have just possibly read On the Road or maybe Big Sur and are interested in dabbling in some of his essays or stories, where would you direct them to?
I would say Dharma Bums, because I would think that would give them more of an understanding of Kerouac's engagement with Buddhism. And I think that that's important. And I think that's another important characteristic or influence of Kerouac and Gary Snyder, who you mentioned before, is that during the 1950s, they were responsible for sort of introducing more and more white Americans to Eastern philosophy. And so the book is an important one in American history for that reason. So I would say Dharma Bums. And then I would say, so there are a trilogy of, it's known as the Lowell Trilogy, and there are a trilogy of books that deal with Kerouac's childhood and teenage years in Lowell, Massachusetts. And those are Visions of Gerard, Dr. Sachs, and Maggie Cassidy. And I think reading one of those three would be really instructional and engaging for readers. I think it would give them allow them to see a side of Kerouac which is quite different than the side that they get in On the Road.
Was American literary critic and writer Todd Titchen. The Unknown Kerouac is published by the Library of America and retails for just under €30 in hardback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Ronan Burnock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the cautionary words of Rutger Bregman from his best-selling book, Utopia for Realists, where Rutger argues, "The real crisis of our times, of my generation, is not that we don't have it good or that we might be worse off later on. No, the real crisis is that we can't come up with anything better." Sobering words indeed. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.